Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners. If you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
One, two, tres, cuatro.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we'll be talking with Robert Finley, whose album Sharecropper's Son was one we both loved in 2021. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, let's review some new music. That's a track called Gasoline from the new Weekend album called Dawn FM, the fifth studio album from Abel Tesfaye, born and raised in Toronto. Began his recording career in 2009. I remember this vividly. He was putting out all this stuff kind of anonymously on YouTube, and then he released those three EPs, one on top of another, House of Balloons, Thursday, and Echoes of Silence. A new sound for R&B, very dark, sinister-sounding records. Acclaimed. Nobody knew who this guy was. Didn't give any interviews.
No. Or how to pronounce Weekend. W-E-E-K-N-D.
Correct. But he has since gone on to a huge amount of fame. Released four studio albums since then. Kissland in 2013. Beauty Behind the Madness 2015. Starboy in 2016. And a huge record called After Hours in 2020. Preceding Dawn FM. Four number one albums, 15 top 10 singles. Blinding Lights from the last album spent 4 weeks atop the Billboard Hot 100 and also broke the record for most weeks in the Hot 100's top 10. I mean, no other single was more successful in the history of the Billboard Top 100. And the album did pretty well, too. Number one, biggest streaming week for an R&B album ever. Was snubbed for the 2021 Grammy nominations. Usually they get these kind of things right. They get the sort of the pop stratosphere correctly.
It was so big it would be impossible to ignore, except for the Grammys, who never gets anything right.
It was just nuts. So Buddy's back with a new record beginning the new year. Dawn FM is the name of the record. We're going to review it in a second. It's called Less Than Zero from The Weeknd on Sound Opinions.
That is Less Than Zero from Dawn FM, the new album by The Weeknd, a.k.a. Abel Tesfaye. You know, Greg, the word was that The Weeknd was working throughout 2020, a dark year for all of us. After Hours, another album that he eventually shelved because he thought it would be too dark. What is that saying? Because Abel Tesfaye has given us some very, very dark music. this album, in comparison to his catalog, though not everything, Dawn FM is a ray of sunshine in many ways. You know, the conceit is this is a radio show or a radio station that is coming at you with kind of the best of 70s disco influences and 80s house music as processed by this brilliant, thoroughly modern day producer of R&B and soul music. You know, it is not a repudiation in any way of his earlier darker themes. He is still incredibly self-reflective, and he doesn't always like what he sees in the mirror. I've been so cold to the ones who love me, baby. I look back now and I realize
the last few months I've been working on me, baby. There's so much trauma in my life. I've been so cold to the ones who love me, baby. I look back now and I realize.
However, like many musicians, we've said this a dozen times over the last year, year and a half. You know, when you're cooped up at home in dark and troubling times, sometimes you just want to dance around the living room. And there is more of that, I think, than we've ever heard from the weekend before. Or is it just me? I mean, it was striking me as a sunnier overall album than he's given us, and a really sophisticated one. I mean, he grows more and more into that realm of just, you know, like, this guy is Prince. This guy is a new generation's Prince.
I would agree with that. I think the guy's made an incredible record. You know, it is sort of a reset for him. You're correct in saying that the dark stuff has sort of been, and not necessarily shoved to the past. He definitely addresses it right up top. But, you know, he's fashioning this in sort of a three-part journey. He's addressing this person that he is, that he no longer likes that guy.
Yeah.
And he's looking at it from an older, wiser perspective. You know, that album cover, for people who still care about album covers, creeps me out more than just about anything Abel Tesfaye has given us.
Yeah.
I'm going, this is an older Abel Tesfaye, and he's like, you know, this old...
Well, that computer aging...
Gray-haired, yeah. You know, R&B singer, you know, of the past.
Well, he looks like this guy who lives in a cave and comes out only to shout at
people.
Like
you see these guys on street corners or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a rough... He's had a rough go here. But I think it's also to tell us he's kind of a little older and wiser. He's looking back and saying, okay, I needed to clean this up. I got to start liking myself again. I got to start treating other people with respect. And the journey of that, you know, this whole idea of being stuck in the middle of something and finding, looking towards the light, that's kind of the big theme of the radio station / concept album that he's made here. But the music, you know, none of that would matter if the music wasn't any good. And it is spectacularly good. You know, you were mentioning that he was there. There's a lot of old school references here. There's a lot of Euro disco. I hear a lot of Michael Jackson influence, early Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Quincy Jones does one of those little interludes on the record.
A dreaded moment. I'm just going to start a I hate interludes campaign.
I know. I mean, they do sort of break it up a little bit, but he does give it some context. He's talking about, you know, you can't outgrow your past. And in a way, The Weeknd is trying to do that. But, I you know, when I think of a track like How Do I Make You Love Me, the segueing into Take My Breath, that 5.5 minutes of just euphoric music. Euphoric. I never thought I'd be using that word with The Weeknd,
with
but
the
here
Weeknd.
It is, you know?
Yeah.
And Out of Time, that is just a spectacular track. That is going to be a huge, huge hit. And it's going to be a huge hit that a lot of other people who don't normally listen to The Weeknd's music are going to love, because it's just so well-crafted. So I think it's a triumph for him. I think it's the best album he's ever made.
Oh, yeah. You got to recognize that sound, Greg. It is Neil Young and Crazy Horse playing in a barn on an album appropriately titled Barn. The, well, you know, Truth in Advertising from Neil. The count is 41 solo albums from Neil Young, 14 of those with Crazy Horse, his favorite backing band. Neil Young really needs no introduction at age 76 as of last November. I have considered the last decade or so since his near brush with death with a brain aneurysm, a gift. I'm so glad Neil is still with us. Does he occasionally give us cheesy music? Yes. Does he occasionally give us brilliant music? Yes. Sometimes track by track, they vary. But it is always good news for any Neil Young fan that he is reunited with Crazy Horse, albeit this is a different Crazy Horse. Frank Pancho San Pedro, his longtime second guitarist in The Horse, has officially retired. Nils Lofgren is taking his place. Nils has been, on and off into the Neil cast of characters for years, so that's not bad. And you have the longtime core of Crazy Horse, the rhythm section of Ralph Molina and Billy Talbot, drums and bass respectively, both at the ripe young age of 78, kicking things off on Barn. Neil needs no further introduction. Let's play a track and give our thoughts on what he is giving us. This is a song called Human Race by Neil Young and Crazy Horse from Barn.
Who's gonna tell the children of destiny that we didn't try to save the world for them?
Fires and floods.
The human race is on. We're all lined up at the starting gun. The crowd is rising to its feet.
That is Human Race from the new Neil Young album, Barn. You made the point that Nils Lofgren is in the band. Frank Pancho San Pedro, longtime Crazy Horse member, retired. It's a different sound with Nils in the band. With San Pedro, they were really punching out those rockers. Nils gives it more of a textural kind of approach. He's playing a bunch of instruments on this record. There's that piano and accordion sort of giving some different flavors to the record. It's more low-key than you might expect from a Neil and Crazy Horse record. But that doesn't make it a bad record. In fact, I think it's probably, for my ears, the best thing he's done in about a decade. I really like this record. He's not breaking a ton of ground. In fact, you think about this whole obsession with the past. Neil has had that from the very earliest days when he was a kid writing Sugar Mountain, looking back fondly on the years that have lied. I'm 19 now. I'm losing my youth. It's gone.
You can't be 20 on Sugar Mountain. Right. He's 19 at the time. I know.
And, Journey to the Past early on in his career. He's already talking about, on this track, when I was a little boy, I dragged my wagon all through the town. And I'm heading west. Well, he's been dragging his past all through the town ever since. I mean, that's such a big part of him. But the past as it informs the future. And on this one, I wanted to play Human Race because that, to me, is the key track on the record. Who's going to tell the kids that we didn't try to save the world for them? You know, basically, that's the sentiment of that song.
Yeah.
He's saying, we screwed up, and we're owning our past, and we didn't do a very good job of it. You know, we're trying to build this future for the world so that it can survive, so that our children and grandchildren can survive in it.
And we're blowing
it. And we screwed up. The judgment is soon coming down. I can't quite remember what it was that I knew. He sings that song right out on that track, They Might Be Lost.
Yeah.
That's a classic Neil trope. He's out on the porch, smoking a joint, reminiscing about the sky and the planet and himself in that planet.
Coming down the highway, just made the turn. They called to let me know. She's asking me again, and the smoke that I burn keeps taking me to the old days.
Now, you ain't kidding, Greg. I mean, Neil has been a green hippie his entire life. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s, in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s, and still today. He is a hippie, and he has never apologized for being one. That idea of a utopia being accessible. I'm older now, but I'm still dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
I find that encouraging in these times of prevailing pessimism. Neil still believes that that people can make a difference, that we can save not only the planet, maybe we can save this country that he loves and hates, which brings us to Canarican. All right. Famously, Neil is from Canada. Famously, he has spent the vast majority of his 76 years as an American, a great observer of America, sometimes surprising us, you know, taking on George Bush's points, 1,000 points of light, right? But also urging us to consider that even Richard Nixon has got soul.
Right.
You know, he really is a great observer of the United States. And in this song, he is wondering what happened to this country that he loves, that he adopted, that he spent his life in. Why are people at each other's throats on the cusp of a civil war to the point where they can't even come together to save the aforementioned planet for the aforementioned grandchildren? I mean, is that a great song or is it a dumb song? Is it like The Weeknd? I don't know whether this is brilliant or stupid.
It's kind of a little bit of both. Neil is like that, you know?
Yes.
And the thing about Neil is he doesn't edit himself a lot. You know, Ramshackle is Neil. Neil is Ramshackle. I mean, it's just going to be, you're going to, you know, and there's going to be people who don't get it, never will and don't want to.
Yeah.
And I can't blame them. But at the same time, there's a sort of a homespun veracity to everything he does. Like there seem to be no false moves in his world. It's like everything he's doing in that moment, he sincerely believes in it.
Especially in a barn, especially playing in that barn with Crazy Horse. I will depart from your view about the grunge missing, only to the extent that, you know, in my opinion, after Farmer John, the cover of that great 60s garage stomp song from Ragged Glory, Crazy Horse never had to do that again. You know what I mean? I mean, they've perfected
it.
You know, the fuzz is there. I can live with Nils Lofgren. I am happy, really just gleeful that Ralph Molina and Billy Talbot still have that groove. I mean, they lock into that Cortez the Killer groove, and you can just write. You can write it for 10 minutes, for 20 minutes. You can write it for this whole album. And to me, Crazy Horse, everybody talks about the guitars, but it's always been about the groove. Long may they run.
There you go. Welcome back, as he says. That's what we think of the latest from The Weeknd and Neil Young, and now we want to hear from you. Let us know in our Facebook group or in our Patreon community, or leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, so we can play it on the show. Plus, we'll revisit our conversation with Peter Bogdanovich about his 2007 Tom Petty documentary. That's up next on Sound Opinions. I saw the fire.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Disconnect from everything I think I know. Release my mind, my thought and growth. Found a place where I can stay. Now don't you take my thrill away. Don't say.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot, and he's Jim DeRogatis. That's a little bit of the song Don't Play from the new Turnstile album, Glow On. quartet formed in 2010 out of Baltimore's hardcore scene. Put out a couple of EPs, a full-length debut in 2015. Got signed to a major label deal with Roadrunner. And put out the Time and Space album in 2018. Now we have a new Turnstile album. They've been making a lot of buzz on that hardcore scene, but they are expanding out of it slowly but surely. Mike Elizondo is the producer on this one. That's kind of a departure from hardcore norm. Elizondo's, you know, his credits include 50 Cent's Into Club. Eminem's The Real Slim Shady. He co-wrote those songs. He's co-produced a lot of records that have made the pop charts. And he's done bands everywhere from Mastodon to Avenged Sevenfold, you know, from the harder-edged part of the scene. Now we have his production on Turnstile's Glow On. Here's a track from it called Blackout from Turnstile on Sound Opinions.
That is Blackout from Turnstile. The album is Glow On. Greg, you turned me on to these fellows as a buried treasure, I believe. And the album is really a fantastic listen. Sucked me in, kept me playing it. It was on repeat for a couple of days around the house. I kept thinking, this is Pelican meet Battles. All right. Yeah. Pelican, a great Chicago-based hardcore, metalcore, whatever you want to call that harder-edged, harder-hitting sound these days. But with the, you know, synthesizer sonics and inventions, the soundscape, the weird soundtrack kind of mentality that Battles brought to its inventive records, which we loved. You know, there is a lot of just sonic coloration in this mix, as well as some real headbanging worthy aggression. And you know, I don't know. It you feel like you're driving a steamroller, but you're in a Looney Tunes cartoon. I love that. I really love that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a band that's pithy, and I guess that's where they get the hardcore credentials from. 14 of the 15 tracks on the new album are clocking at under 3 minutes. But, you know, to call them a hardcore band, you know, it's like Effed Up came out of the hardcore scene, but they're really not a hardcore band anymore.
They're so much more
than that. You know, the band out of, a great band out of Canada that we've reviewed several times on the show. Turnstile sort of reminds me of that ethos. As you mentioned, kind of a cut-up style that incorporates all sorts of musical influences. And Elizondo's bringing that out, and they are down with this idea. They don't want to be, you know, remain in the hardcore ghetto. They want this expansive sound while retaining that energy that has always been at the heart of their best music.
Well, you gave Elizondo's you know, rap sheet, and I think Mastodon is what connected probably with Turnstile.
You know, who knows? I mean, he's done some great work across. I believe, you know, I remember him in connection with a Fiona Apple record years ago. Doing a great job on that. You know, but here's, you know, they got this Latin funk breakdown in the middle of that track called Mystery, and New Heart Design sounds like a synth pop track. You know, it doesn't sound like, oh, this is supposed to be a guitar-based hardcore band. No, they're doing all this other stuff. You know, those otherworldly vocal effects on Underwater Boy. The way those hand claps come in Don't Play. You know, a ballad with Dev Hines of Blood Orange, you know. They're really expanding the palette here, and the songs really work. I mean, musically, this record is incredibly rich. You know, lyrically, I'm not looking for profundity from these guys. They don't give me much. But at the same time, exuberance seems to be the overriding theme. I want to live large is what they're saying, you know. Mm-hmm. And if it makes you feel alive, well, then I'm happy to provide, they sing on Blackout. My favorite lyric on the album, Jim?
Yeah.
I need more boom, boom, boom.
And they deliver that. Yeah, they do deliver it. So, Greg, you did play Turnstile last week as part of your mixtape, and the album came out in August, and I was like, I don't know, what is Cot running out of things to talk about? But I was glad you said this album deserves a full review, because I've been living it with it for a week and loving it.
Yeah, the Turnstile's had a long history. I don't think they've ever made a record quite as accomplished as at this one. It's impressive that the band is showing up on a lot of year-end lists as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to acknowledge this record as one of the better releases of the last year.
If you haven't heard them, you deserve to discover them. So that's what we thought about Turnstile. You can leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, and give us your thoughts. Now we turn to a conversation that had aired back in 2008.
That's right, Jim. We were lucky enough to have chatted with the late director Peter Bogdanovich. He died on January 6th at the age of 82 from complications related to Parkinson's disease. And now you may be thinking, what does he have to do with music? Of course, Bogdanovich and his partner Polly Platt made three timeless films in the 70s, including The Last Picture Show. But it was in 2007 when Bogdanovich directed the Tom Petty documentary, Running Down a Dream, that we interviewed him for Sound Opinions.
It's kind of a shame. Many of the obituaries that ran left that off his filmography. So let's us dive into that conversation.
That's Running Down a Dream from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, the title song, as it were, from a four-hour documentary that has been airing on the Sundance Channel in recent months and is now out on DVD, a four-hour documentary about the career and life of Tom Petty and his band, the Heartbreakers, directed by no slouch in the directing department, Peter Bogdanovich, Oscar-winning director, who's broke through in the early 70s with a movie called The Last Picture Show, one of the most acclaimed Hollywood movies ever. He also directed The Mask with Cher in it in the mid-80s. Got a long history in Hollywood, got a long history as a documentarian and a journalist.
And people probably know him recently from appearing on The Sopranos.
Absolutely.
As the Shrink's Shrink. We've got Peter Bogdanovich on the phone from his hotel room in New York City. Welcome to Sound Opinions, Peter.
Thank you.
Peter, you have done a four-hour documentary on Tom Petty, Running Down a Dream, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. It's airing on the Sundance Channel. It is out in DVD. You are a man who picks big subjects. You have done major work on people like Orson Welles. You've written a book about Orson Welles. You've written a book and done a documentary on John Ford. Tom Petty, does he fit into that pantheon of great men, great artists in American history? Obviously, he does for you.
Yeah, well, that was what interested me about him. I think he's a very talented, gifted, brilliant American artist, and I approached the documentary with that point of view.
Yeah, when did you become a fan? I mean, what was it about Petty that interested you?
I didn't become a fan until I did this movie.
Really?
I'd heard a couple of songs, but I didn't know much about him, which is one of the reasons that interested me, because, I mean, I knew he was good, and Tom liked my movies and wanted to meet me and was interested in having me do this.
Mm-hmm.
So we met in November of 05, and we hit it off very well immediately, and that was the beginning of it. You know, I just thought he was so American in the best possible sense. He was really a native American artist with a sense of Americana that was very acute, I thought.
It's interesting, Peter, because I think what you see with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And the more you watch your documentary, you realize this band has had a 30-year run. And it's not like they're the Rolling Stones, where it's this multi-million-dollar mega corporation. I mean, the Heartbreakers are, I suppose, are a corporation in their own right. But what this is really is a story of a working American rock and roll band, and the rarity of being able to hang together. It's almost like peeling back the curtain, and how does a band work and how does it stay together for that length of time? I mean, is that how you started seeing the story? Because that's the way I see your movie in a way.
Yes, it is. It's very much the story. You know, I determined right away, right from the first meeting, that I'd like Tom to tell the story. I found him very charismatic in a non-show dog kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of reminded me of, not specifically, but he reminded me of somebody like Gary Cooper, somewhat laconic, laid back, the epitome of cool, actually, and very and quintessentially American, Southern American, too. As you know, the South is a font of extraordinary writers, from Mark Twain and Thomas Wolfe and William Faulkner and Truman Capote. I mean, Tennessee Williams is an amazing... Most of the great American writers somehow come from the South. And I think there's something about the South that just sets it apart. And Tom is very much a representative of that. So I decided early on that we weren't going to have a narrator. We'd have Tom tell the story, and of course the band and the people around him. So we interviewed about 28 people.
Yeah, you do a very thorough job of journalism, and Peter, you are a great journalist. You've done some amazing work as a journalist even before you were a director.
Thank you.
And it shows in this documentary.
I think the fact that I was asking the questions, it was very important to me that I do the interviews and that I ask the questions, even though in many cases the producer, George Drakoulias, who's a record producer and who had the idea to put us together, Tom and me, George would slip me questions as we were doing the interview. When it got to certain something that there was an interesting tangent or something, a nuance that I wasn't aware of, he would pass me a note. But it was very important to me that the interviewees were talking to me when it was happening, because I bring a certain baggage into the room, and I felt that they'd be more honest and more straightforward with me than they would with somebody else.
No, it's true. I thought that was a failing in Scorsese's documentary with Dylan, is that he never sat down and interviewed Dylan himself.
Yeah.
Not to diss another director. But Peter, it's a four-hour film, and it sucks you right through. It doesn't feel like it's that long, both on Sundance and on DVD.
Well, that's a big compliment. I'm glad. That was what we were trying to do. At a certain point in the process, we realized that it was going to be long. I mean, I knew it was going to be, it couldn't be short because we're dealing with 30 years. And in fact, you mentioned the Scorsese Dylan picture, and Marty took 3 hours and 40 minutes to tell 6 years of Dylan. And I figured if that's the case, well, why shouldn't we take 4 hours to tell 30 years of Tom Petty?
Well, now, he's really a self-effacing character, Tom Petty. Greg and I have both interviewed him any number of times. He's always most loquacious when he's telling stories about other people. He's always wanting to tell us George Harrison stories, which are very funny. But was there a point where he said to you, he started this ball rolling, but was there a point where he said to you, I don't know if I want this much of me up there on that screen?
There were certain areas that took a little pushing to keep them going.
I think there's two kind of key revelations for me about this movie. One was you got into these issues about his upbringing, his relationship with his father specifically, as being fuel for his artistic freedom.
There was an extreme rage in me that from time to time would show its head through a lot of my life. Any sort of injustice just outraged me. I just couldn't contain myself. And this comes from my dad just being so incredibly verbally abusive to me. And he was certainly physically abusive at times. He would give me pretty good beatings most of my life.
How did that sort of emerge, that childhood really shaped him? And he played rock and roll, and rock and roll really did save this kid's life.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we had glimmers of it in the interviews with Tom. He made certain references to his dad and the situation he was in and the difficult childhood, but he didn't get into details. But other people did. His brother told me about it. and his daughter mentioned it. So once I felt that Tom really trusted me, I pushed him to tell me more about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't do all our interviews in one lump. We did them over a period of months.
You know, one other extraordinary scene in the movie I thought was the scene from the early 90s where Petty is in a recording studio, it looks like, with Roger McGuinn, one of his heroes, the founder of the Byrds. And there's a record company guy there trying to get Roger to record a certain song, and Petty's looking at the song going, what is this crap?
Because sometimes the commercial road, you know, like thinking that that's the road to take isn't always the road to take. Sometimes just doing stuff from your heart and being really honest with people works much better.
Well, let's change some lyrics.
Why don't you just give him a song?
I'm just curious how you came across that piece of film footage.
Well, that was interesting. We were interviewing Roger, and Roger brought it up. He says, we've got this, you know, this confrontation that happened, and somebody shot it, and Roger had a copy of it. Tom didn't have a copy of it, but Roger did.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything about it till Roger brought it up. And I thought it was a perfect example of, you know, Tom's integrity and the steadfastness in the face of authority.
Yeah.
He was going to stand, he wasn't going to back down from his opinion that it was a lousy song, that this guy shouldn't be singing it. It's one of the highlights of the movie. In fact, in a couple of screenings I've been with audiences where we had, you know, 400 people or something, there were a lot of considerable cheering in that section.
Yeah.
And yeah, and so on. Particularly the screening we had in L.A. where it was a lot of industry people.
Well, Petty's a guy who put his money where his mouth is, fought with his record company to charge consumers less. We've been talking to Peter Bogdanovich, director of Running Down a Dream, the extraordinary new Tom Petty film. Peter, I think we're remiss if we let you go. As a fellow rock fan, as a film great on your own, if we didn't ask you, what's your favorite rock movie of all time?
Well, I don't know. I looked at a lot of the documentaries that have been made, and I didn't want to make one like them. What I wanted to do was a vision that I had right after Tom and I talked, right as I was beginning to work on it. I said I wanted a movie where we had a lot of people talking, but we didn't sit on their faces for very long. I didn't want a lot of talking heads cross-cutting. I wanted to have a lot of images. I wanted the talking heads not to be talking heads so much as narrators. I wanted it to be more of a movie,
mm-hmm,
where you could follow the story visually. So I had this vision of what the movie should be like. I wish I could say it was easy to achieve that goal. It was a really twisting, turning road to get to where we got. But it did turn out the way I imagined it would. But there were many times along the year and a half, almost 2 years that we spent on it, where I thought, I don't know how we're going to get to this place.
Yeah.
Because it was hard, you know.
Well, it absolutely works. Thank you, Peter, for sharing some time with us. I also have to say, as a guy who grew up in Jersey City and Hoboken, man, The Sopranos, you were great.
Thank you so much. You're very kind.
I thought you could really hear Bogdanovich's fandom for Petty when we were talking to him.
Well, he discovered the artist through making the documentary, and I think, you know, connecting his appreciation for Petty's music, you know, he's always been sort of enamored with these American heroic type figures, these classic American, you know, icons. And, you know, for him, Petty fit into that mold.
When we return, a conversation with the blues artist Robert Finley. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. You can stand me up. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
And we are back. From growing up on a farm, the son of a sharecropper, to warming the hearts of many TV viewers on America's Got Talent, Robert Finley has come out with one of Greg's favorite albums of 2021. Ain't that right, Greg?
Well, Jim, absolutely. I was immediately struck by this guy's voice. I mean, it exudes, you know, power and sincerity and emotional attachment to the subject matter. And the way he's singing these lyrics, you know, he wrote these songs about what it was like to grow up as a sharecropper's son. And Dan Auerbach said, you know, Robert, tell your story.
Yeah.
And he told his story in a series of songs, one after the other. Just the honesty blows me away, and the power in that voice really sticks with me.
Well, I love the album, too. And it is really an album as autobiography, but Stream of Consciousness has delivered from the back porch over a couple of beverages. And that is exactly what it was like to talk to Robert. We talked with Robert about the album and what it was like to sing on America's Got Talent, among other things.
Sold out on you. It's sad, but it's true. After all we've been through, I'm sold out on you.
We are honored to welcome Robert Finley to Sound Opinions. Robert, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Well, Robert, you've had an incredible life and a late bloomer, as they say, in music from a standpoint of the recording studio. But I think it's telling that your new album is called Sharecropper's Son. And that takes us right back to the beginning, doesn't it? That's where you grew up, right?
Yeah, that's where I grew up at, down in Winnsboro, Louisiana.
What was that experience like for you working on a farm?
Oh, man, I'm telling you, sharecroppers never got their share. That's for damn sure. Oh, always man. Got the short end of the stick, man. And like I say in the song, it was hard, but it was fair.
You've made some great observations about those years where I saw one interview where you were chatting, if somebody killed a hog, they'd share with all the farmers, all the sharecroppers.
If one person in the neighborhood killed a hog, everybody had meat, you know. Now, man, neighbors kill a hog, you never know anything about it. That was a use for everything. I mean, the song takes the older people down memory lane, but it's history to the young people, because nowadays nobody reads a history book. If you want to know something about the past, you ask Siri, what went on in 1929, you know? I did a show with Mr. Bobby Rush. He was doing something for the Boys and Gloves Club. Me and him was talking about the same thing, that growing up in a small town, everybody kind of knew everybody and everybody looked out for everybody. Great place to raise your kids. On one of my albums, my first album called Age Don't Mean a Thing. And I tell the story about the young people, that it's good to be from a small town and it's great that everybody come together. But at the same time, everybody is in everybody's business. And
yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, in the city, people live in an apartment for months and don't even know the person across the hall don't know the name of the family because nobody cares. Everybody goes in their house and they shut their door. People don't communicate. I came to this little town, Bernice, over 35 years ago, and I wasn't here a week before everybody in town knew I was here because there was a stranger in town. And the fact that I played music, I played one Saturday at the ballpark because somebody asked me, could I play the guitar? The guitar is always a door opener. So I was riding around with the guitar neck sticking out of the car. And I pull up to a ball game. And I pull it out and started singing. And everybody lose interest in the game and left the ball game. Can't get around my car, you know. How they say your gifts open doors for you. If you got a talent, always display it because it makes so many more things possible for you. Regardless of what you got, if you don't display it and people don't know you got it, there's no way it's going to sell or nobody's going to be interested in it. So I tell young kids, whatever you can do, make it known. But the more that you do it, the better you become at doing it and the more confident you come at doing whatever you're trying to do.
Never had time for playing. Never had to have no fun. Too much cotton horn, and that's too much ground to be done. It was hard, but it was fair. But we was all.
You know, when you've talked about, Sharecropper's Son is an autobiographical record about your upbringing, and you've said you actually freestyled large parts of it. You were improvising lyrics at the mic. It was just like talking to you, Robert. You're telling stories, but in this case, you were singing them for the microphone.
Right. The band had came in, and they were warming up, and I was in the front of the studio, and I heard it, and I liked it, the vibes. I was in there bobbing my head to the beat, and Dan say, sing something to it. I didn't have, like, time to write anything, and I had already thought about the Sharecropper's Son. Every time I passed by a cotton field, it hurt my back. So the thought had come, and I was wanted to write about it. So when they started playing the music and asked me to improvise, I just started to doing that, you know, about my upbringing, about the farm and stuff. It got longer and longer and longer, and we was having fun. It looked like it wasn't going to ever end, and they wasn't trying to stop, and I wasn't trying to stop. And so that's how we came up with the Sharecropper's Son, the Country Boy, and Country Child. Because all three of them was just made up as we were going. It was just one long song, and we didn't want to discard any of it, so we just chopped it down into three pieces. The further we got, the more fun we was having in it. This would be like Isaac Hayes' album, I Stand Accused. If we had did it, would have took up the whole side of a 33 vinyl, you know, and made it into three different songs. And the only thing they really did was basically change the bass line, but all three songs were actually made up at one time. Well, when I was on America Got Talent, we finally worked our way up to the live show. And when we got a chance to do the live show, I wanted to show my songwriting skills because this was the biggest opportunity I'd had to do it. And so I called and they agreed that we'd go into Nashville and write this song especially for America Got Talent. And the name of the song was Finally Starting to See.
I've been around the world and it's all the same. Just like the wind.
We had finished the song and the band had to come in and do their part. So that was just the piano that Bobby was playing that we was writing to. My way of writing is give me a groove and let me freestyle. And Dan's way of writing is write out the lyrics and then we create the music around it. So we were totally opposite of the way we wrote. But we decided we'd do it both ways. So we're like, okay, let's do it your way and then let's try it my way. And we found out we both liked it. And besides that, he already had 7 Grammys sitting on the shelf. That kind of impressed me.
He's accomplished a few things, yeah. Dan Auerbach. All right, now, Robert, you know, I've read that as a little kid, the first time you saw a performer on TV, you said, I'm going to be on TV someday. And it only took 55, 60 years for this unlikely break of America's Got Talent. I mean, you are not the sort of artist they generally feature, you know, and I've heard you ask that question, but I got to ask it again. How the heck do you wind up on America's Got Talent?
I didn't do anything to get on America's Got Talent. We never applied for it or anything, nor did the record label apply for it. But what happened, one of the young ladies that was the producer on the show, heard something on YouTube or something, and she contacted my manager and asked me, would I come on the show? And I was like, thousands of people is auditioning to get on this show, and now they asking me, do I mind coming? And I'm like, why not? What do we got to lose? And me and my daughter was in Caribbean Island, I think, when that happened. We was finna fly home, and when they called and told us about the show, we decided to just stay on the island because it was cheaper for the show to pay, because they was going to fly us from home to Los Angeles at the time. My record label was going to fly us back. The first thing I did on it was get it while you can.
You gotta take it when you can get it. Get it while you can. Wrap in bacon, sizzle it in your pan. Now it may not come in the mailbox, it might come in a moving van, but you gotta take it when
I think that was the first show that I did it on. We got a standing ovation from the audience, and the only person I was kind of worried about was Simon. When my daughter say, Simon is giving you a standing ovation, I was like, you see, this guy here is, to me, was going to be the biggest problem, and he turned out being my biggest fan, and I was like, oh, wow, we need to keep going. He had told me that he wanted to talk with me after the show, and then they found out at the time I was getting into one contract and trying to get out of another. I'm kind of glad we lost off the show because I didn't want to sign for 5 years. $1 million sound like a lot of money, but by the time everybody get their piece of the pie, you know, it's not that much left.
Well, for a guy who has talked about there were years at a stretch where you lived on $25 a week.
Right.
Getting offered $1 million, that's a big jump there, Robert.
Yeah. The thing is, you struggle so hard to get independence and you struggle so hard to get freedom, and then you turn around and sell it. It's just like buying a new car. You got to go to work whether you want to or not because you got to pay the note. Everybody's going to know if you lose that new car what you're dealing with. You know, everybody's going to know that you're going from a brand new car to back to walking.
You've had a long career in music before you were even known. I mean, you started out playing in the church, right? And then the army band, and then busking on the street corners. What did you learn from those experiences? Because obviously when you started your career in your 60s, you already had a sound and it seemed like you were ready to go. You know, it's a long apprenticeship. But what did you learn from each of those experiences prior to starting to record your own music?
Now, that was a show called the Ernie Miles Show. That was a gospel show that came on every Sunday morning. Mr. Miles always told me, boy, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. It was so encouraging, you know, until I got to where he would show something of me every Sunday on his show. I would go on a Saturday and do a recording the first Saturday of the month. And all I had to do was sing 4 songs and he would play one each Sunday for that month. So that was one way a lot of people knew me from the TV show playing gospel.
Thank you, Robert, for taking the time to chat with us. We hope to see you soon.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me, man. And bye-bye.
That wraps up our conversation with Robert Finley. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have an interview with one of our favorite artists who made one of the best albums of 2021, Adia
yes.
Victoria. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed, where this week we're airing the entirety of our interview with the late Peter Bogdanovich.
Good stuff, Greg. For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our intern, Mary Bernthal. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.